website. So before we kick into the content, let me go first to Mr. Gary Kleinman, who is the Regional Administrator for Region 1 for ASPR within the Department of Health and Human Services. Gary.
Paul, thanks so much. Good morning, everybody. I will promise to keep my remarks brief and welcome you to the program this morning. We are, as always, really grateful to the RDHRS for providing the kind of subject matter expertise to help our healthcare partners, our public health partners, our planning partners around the region. Just yesterday, ASPR rolled out an initiative to expedite and expand the availability of monoclonal antibody therapies to priority populations, including long-term care facilities and community health centers, in addition to the effort that ASPR has undertaken to provide these to the facilities for infusion that have been designated by state health departments. So we're making the effort to increase both the availability and the equity of distribution of these therapies. And it's particularly important as we, you know, the shiny object has been the announcement of vaccine availability, and it's likely that by the end of the week or the weekend, FDA will give due consideration and the advisory committee as well to Moderna's candidate for the vaccine. But while the vaccine is being made available, and we're hopeful that it will provide the kinds of rates of immunity that will actually flatten the curve eventually, in the meantime, taking care of the patients who are sick is really critically important. And the promise of these antibody therapies for that purpose is really quite important. So I don't know that my colleague Russ has been able to make it on. I'll pause and see if he has, and happy to yield to him. And otherwise, Paul, will go back to you.
Great. Thanks so much, Gary. I don't think I see him right now. I know, obviously, like all of us, so many competing commitments. But I do very much want to thank you and ASPR, as well as FEMA Region 1, for your tremendous continued support, as always. To move forward, I think, Gary, you set this up very, very nicely, that there have been two emergency use authorizations issued for monoclonal antibody therapies for patients with mild to moderate COVID-19. Clearly, most of New England is in the midst of a surge of patients with COVID-19, and the hospital systems are under strain. We are months away, many months away, from large-scale vaccination of the public as more vaccines receive emergency use authorization and ultimately are able to be administered to the public. And so we're all trying to find the best ways that we can evaluate how to use the therapies that are available to us, as well as the medical resources in terms of staff and space and other planning bandwidth that we have as effectively as possible. These two monoclonal antibody therapies certainly have some challenges that I think everyone on the webinar knows about, with the fact that they require an outpatient infusion for patients who are in their infectious period, that the drug, like all initial drugs that are first developed and under emergency use authorization, are limited in supply. We have to identify patients early in their course of disease and get this therapy to them quickly if we are to be most effective in the science, as we'll hear more about shortly. And we have to do this in an equitable way. I think clearly you cannot talk about COVID-19 and this pandemic in any way without also talking about inequity and the effects that that's had on patients' health across all of our communities. So I really am so glad that we have two extraordinary speakers who put more time than you could possibly imagine into the planning for monoclonal antibody therapies within Massachusetts and within the Mass General Brigham Healthcare System. So this is meant for everyone within the region and others who may be tuning in to offer helpful advice, suggestions, thoughts in the planning effort so that we can all learn from each other's practices and experience. So with that, I will stop. I will turn it over to Dr. Rubin for her remarks. And again, really, really great gratitude for both you and Dr. Lennis to joining. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Paul. I'm happy to join. Thanks for asking me. As both Gary and Paul said, these therapies are therapies that holds significant promise, but there is an evolving base of evidence around their use. So I'm going to start with some basic background. Bamlanivimab is, which was the first product, the first monoclonal antibody to receive EUA for patients with COVID-19. It's a neutralizing IgG1 monoclonal antibody that binds receptor binding domain of the spike protein of the SARS-CoV-2 virus, and this is the Lilly product. The evidence for on which the EUA was based was a phase 2 trial, BLAZE-1, published in the New England Journal, that suggested reduction in a composite endpoint of hospitalizations and ED visits for outpatients with SARS-CoV-2 and mild to moderate symptoms. So important to note, this was a small study. This was not primary endpoint. The primary endpoint was a reduction in viral load. These numbers were small and not yet statistically significant, but certainly promising if they are borne out in larger data sets. So of all participants, 5 out of 309, so 1.6% in the treatment group versus 9 out of 143, or just over 6%, had either an ED visit or a hospitalization. And then this effect appeared to be more pronounced in high-risk patients, so that was age 65 and over, or with a BMI 35 and over in adult patients, so 18 and over. And that effect appeared to be more pronounced. There were other high-risk patients with other features that put them at high risk in the study, but none of those patients experienced one of the endpoints. So really the evidence in that trial was for age 65 and over, BMI 35 and over. Notably, all patients in that trial received the antibody within 72 hours of the test being sent. So this is early in disease course, and some trials of hospitalized patients have been actually halted due to either lack of benefit and or a signal towards harm. So the earlier the better, as we know from, you know, everything we know about viruses, and we also know from this data. And then clinical trials are ongoing. They've shifted, the bamlanivimab trials have shifted largely to a dual antibody cocktail from Lilly, but those trials are ongoing, and we do expect that in coming weeks there will be additional data that emerges. Next slide, please. So the other product, this is the Regeneron product that received an EUA in recent weeks, is casirivimab and imdevimab, a dual antibody cocktail that has two antibodies that bind to different regions of the same receptor binding domain of the spike protein of SARS-CoV-2. There is no published data yet for this therapy, but by report, there similarly was a reduction in hospitalization and ED visits. Again, similarly small numbers, 2 versus 4% for all participants, 3 versus 9% in high-risk patients. So again, promising, not definitive evidence, but promising if borne out in larger trials. Next slide. So the emergency use authorizations for the two are similar. They both authorize use of the monoclonal antibodies in outpatients with a positive SARS-CoV-2 test with mild or moderate symptoms, with no more than 10 days of symptoms by the time of administration. The EUAs do not specify timing in relation to test performance, although, again, the only published data had patients all receiving this within 72 hours of test performance. It's authorized for use in patients with high risk of progression to severe disease, and that's defined as not only adults age 65 and over and adults with BMI greater than or equal to 35, but patients with chronic kidney disease, diabetes, patients who are immunosuppressed by virtue of immunosuppressive medication or underlying immunosuppressed disease state, patients who are 55 and older with cardiovascular disease, hypertension, COPD, or other chronic respiratory conditions, and then patients aged 12 to 17 with a variety of conditions, including things like sickle cell, obesity with a BMI of greater than or equal to 85th percentile for age, dependence on mechanical support like a tracheostomy or a feeding tube. So these are very broad. As you can see, these are very broad and, you know, often may be difficult to define in the medical record, since some of these things are, you know, diagnoses that people frequently carry and of unclear severity, like COPD. So patients are excluded if they are either newly hypoxic in the setting of COVID-19 or they are requiring more than their baseline supplemental oxygen if they are a patient who requires oxygen at baseline. Next slide, please. So importantly, both the NIH and the Infectious Diseases Society of America have come out with recommendations about bamlanivimab. The NIH said that there's insufficient data to recommend for or against, and that it should not be considered the standard of care. The IDSA similarly recommends against routine use of bamlanivimab in ambulatory patients with COVID-19. That's a conditional recommendation, very low certainty. But they said that in patients at increased risk, it's a reasonable treatment option if after informed decision making, the patient puts a high value on the uncertain benefits and a low value on uncertain adverse events. I will say that in terms of adverse events, the adverse events that have been reported are similar to adverse events from other infusions, a small risk of anaphylaxis during the infusion, vasovagal events during the infusion, you know, rash, hives, other things like that. The incidence of those things has been low, but there certainly is a risk of anaphylaxis, and patients need to receive this in a setting where they can receive treatment for anaphylaxis and resuscitation if necessary. Next slide. So in terms of thinking about how do we fairly allocate a therapy like this, which at least for now will be scarce by virtue of drug availability and or infusion capabilities. So as with any resource that we're allocating, we think about how do we maximize benefit, how do we give it to the people who stand to benefit the most. That is challenging to define here, given the relative paucity of evidence right now that, for example, distinguish between different categories of high-risk patients. We know that, again, the evidence that was published was in high-risk patients was based on age and BMI, but there would certainly, with larger numbers, be more granular evidence of who might benefit the most. We are one of the concerns here, as with anything, but I think particularly here, given the logistics of delivering this therapy and given the disproportionate impact of this disease on certain communities, I think I personally and many are very concerned about ensuring equitable distribution of this and then being transparent. Next slide. This is just a schematic I put together that I think shows a complex balance of factors here that make this challenging to think about doing in a way that's ethical, that is logistically feasible, that does not unduly strain other, you know, our resources in the setting of vaccine campaigns and a surge in critical care patients and other things. So, you know, the things that we have to think about are maximizing benefit, as I said, giving this therapy to those who are most likely to be helped, optimizing shared decision-making, which is challenging given the data. So, you know, we hope that data will emerge that will show clearer evidence of benefit and enable us to articulate that more clearly. But at least now, this is something that reasonable people, you know, would decide different things about. And so shared decision-making is an important feature, and that's challenging under the best of circumstances, but particularly challenging here. We want to make sure we still facilitate research because it's important to ensure we get more definitive answers. And other therapies that have received EUAs like convalescent plasma, research efforts have often sort of stalled in the setting of patients getting the therapy through an EUA and not enrolling in trials. Equity, as we talked about, ensuring access to the hardest hit communities and to the most vulnerable patients. Insurance safety, again, if this is thought to be safe, but there is a small chance of a serious adverse event. And in addition, it may be harmful if administered later in the disease. As we all know, COVID can get severe very quickly, and we don't want to be giving this to patients with severe disease. Also, the speed with which we need to give this presents a challenge logistically, which intersects with, I think, the ethical challenges of distribution. We have to deliver it within a short time window after the test performance and within a window for symptoms. So that makes this extremely complex ethically and logistically. Next slide. So in Massachusetts, sort of as an example of an allocation process, Massachusetts is distributing the drug to institutions that are capable of infusing a certain number of patients and willing to adhere to the state guidance. So far, that is a limited, for good reason, I think a limited number of hospitals and hospital systems have accepted therapy and have felt ready to do this. The allocations are based on infusion capabilities. And then Massachusetts decided that there were clinical tiers with, for the reasons I stated, priority for patients based on age and BMI, and then consideration of other patients only when it has been given to the patients who fall into this tier. Again, these are patients who are known to be at high risk for morbidity and mortality. They're the patients who experienced events in the published data of the high-risk patients. And also, this is in many ways a more identifiable set of characteristics, although there are certainly challenges with identifying patients with high BMI. And Massachusetts made very clear that it was critical to distribute this equitably, with socially vulnerable groups represented in proportion to the impact of the disease on those groups. Next slide. So Massachusetts decided that in the event of scarcity, which exists, again, by virtue of scarce infusion capabilities, that the therapy should be allocated by random allocation by a lottery, but in an effort to ensure that vulnerable patients receive an appropriate proportion of the therapy, that it will be a reserve lottery. So 80% of the units allocated in a lottery available to all patients, including vulnerable patients, and then 20% of the units allocated in the lottery that is designated specifically for socially vulnerable patients as defined by Social Vulnerability Index and or residents in a city or town at a high incidence within the state. The idea being, obviously, the extent to which a lottery fairly allocates depends on the percentage of entrants in different categories and then the percentage of units that are allocated via the lottery. So the reserve can help essentially give a boost to certain patients. And then in addition, participating hospitals and systems must be able to accept referrals from outside their system. This is challenging for a number of reasons, but from an equity standpoint, a lot of patients who are the most vulnerable don't have a PCP, don't have a medical home, get tested at a stop the spread site, and so the institutions have to commit to a process for this. Transportation, to the extent we're doing this in an infusion center, is challenging for a lot of patients, so we need to be able to provide transportation and then to provide regular reporting that demonstrates how we're doing this and that the process is equitable. New slide. So a few of the key challenges, just we've been doing this honestly for several days. We had many days where we were waiting for the drug to be delivered, and we were able to look at the data and sort of assess in advance some of the issues, and then we've been doing this in real time for the last several days. And there are many challenges which, you know, were anticipated, but very interesting to see how this plays out. So, you know, one of the things that we struggle with is how do we identify patients for entry into the lottery? If we rely entirely on providers referring people in, we're concerned about referral bias in favor of those who have kind of the best access, know to ask for this, et cetera. So equity favors entering patients automatically if they are eligible, and that is what we have started out with. But when you enter people automatically without knowing if they will be interested in the therapy, the risk is that you get a low yield on the people who are offered and end up having unused capacity. Our experience so far has been that for often good reasons, patients who are identified in the lottery either are not interested in the therapy or they are now either too well and they have no symptoms or they're too sick to get it. So that is challenging. And the question, as I alluded to before, how do we do shared decision making and by whom? The message is challenging right now. I think if it turns out that the evidence is much more robust, which it may be, it will be less challenging. But the messaging right now involves a complex conversation about a lot of unknowns and personal preference. And that's a challenging message that needs to be delivered well in order to prevent people from feeling confused by a message that we have a therapy with unclear benefits that we're offering. We don't in any way want to sabotage the messages about vaccines and other things, and I think we're all very sensitive to that, particularly with vulnerable populations. Another challenge is how do we preserve research? And we at our institution, where we have trials ongoing, are making specific efforts to try to offer research opportunities and get people into the trials so that we can get the answers we need. And then I think, you know, we've struggled a bit with what does it mean to equitably distribute therapy that we don't know for certain works yet. Again, it may very well turn out to work quite well, but the evidence at this point is not as robust. And so it's challenging to think about what does that mean? Is it okay if vulnerable patients are turning this down in larger percentages than other patients? Because turning it down right now might be a reasonable thing as a person assesses sort of the risks, benefits, the challenges of getting to an infusion center for, you know, a few hours, leaving family, all of those kinds of things. So I think there are many challenges. I think, you know, to the extent that this is, the evidence becomes much more robust, these are things that we are learning from, and it will be an iterative process as we go through and figure out if this is here to stay until COVID-19 is gone so that we can offer therapies to patients who may otherwise progress to severe disease. Then we will iterate the process to the point where it becomes more standard of care, and we think about how do we equitably distribute a standard of care therapy under challenging circumstances. So that is, I think that's my last slide.
Great. So thank you to everyone. Thank you especially to Emmy, who's been a great partner in this work, and to Paul and Gary. My name is Inga Lennis, and I'm going to take you through some of the more logistic operational considerations, and we're going to share with you our workflow, our Visio workflows, in case they could be helpful in your program development. I'm going to skip pretty quickly through some of these slides because I know that Emmy covered most of this already, and you can see here summarized our eligibility, our referral pathway, which, as Emmy said, is automated. So our testing right now happens within the MGB system and is resulted in the Epic system. We have a way through Epic to cull all of the positive COVID tests for patients who are over 65 years old. And if we have height and weight, we can automatically calculate a BMI and generate an automatic referral list in our electronic health record. The specifics after that is that we have designed a lottery system to ensure equity, which involves patient zip codes, and a way to sort that work queue by various other equity characteristics that we would want to make sure that we are using. And then we'll talk a little bit more about the shared decision making. We use a program right now where we have created a group of clinicians that are specifically trained in this. They come from across the Mass General Brigham system. They include some infectious disease doctors, and they've all been similarly trained in the shared decision-making process and have a list of shared decision-making talking points to be using with patients. This group is reaching out to the patients that are automatically identified within our system and having that conversation. And then if patients are agreeable and assent to therapy, they are then scheduled for that therapy. We're using two sites for our treatment, both at MGH and the Brigham right now. And as Emmy said, we have treated about 7 patients since we went live at the end of last week. Only about 15 to 20% of the patients who are offered this therapy are taking us up on it. So it's a complex discussion, and for many reasons that Emmy talked about, patients are not it's been an interesting finding that patients, there's many patients who don't assent to the therapy. So that shared decision-making conversation is really important. And then I'll talk about this at the end. We are working on 2 additional aspects to this. One is at-home infusion, and we've been using some of the CVS capability for at-home infusion and a couple of patients to see how that process is going. We're also talking internally about a program to use our home health system and paramedic group that does home visits to be able to do home infusions, and that work is ongoing and hasn't actually come to fruition yet. But I think that if the safety concerns are met, I think home infusion is a great option. One of the considerations that I want to raise in capacity is it's not just the capacity in terms of the chair availability, nursing availability, et cetera, but we also have to consider what we're displacing. So one of the key considerations in developing this program is the fact that we don't want to be displacing important cancer therapies for patients that need to stay on track and have their cancer treatments. We also don't want to displace non-cancer infusions either. So these infusions have been squeezed into our normal schedule, but we have planned for in the eventuality of additional drug or patient demand that we would be utilizing infusion capacity in the evening time or weekends and times when we don't have regularly scheduled cancer or non-cancer infusions. But this is an important consideration because we have to, it's not just the infusions that we have to, the trade-off with the infusions, but at this point, it's also the staffing. So the other two staffing concerns are the surge staffing. Many of the nurses and APPs in our infusion centers are in high demand on the inpatient side and other places for their care. And as we move into this surge, that's a concern. And then also vaccines. So as our operational team is working on many different things, it's balancing all of those capacity challenges. Next slide, please. So these are very small, but you'll have access to these slides so you can blow them up. This is our high level, and this is for was developed for bamlanivimab, but it's, of course, the same flow for all of the monoclonal antibody therapies. The takeaways from this are that this is, again, an automatic referral that's generated from our Epic system for patients who meet the criteria of the timing of the test, the BMI criteria, the age criteria. If we are oversubscribed in terms of our capacity, there is a lottery process. And then we are reaching out to make sure that they are scheduled expeditiously. We also are working on making sure that we're offering a research pathway for those that are more inclined to take part in a research trial. And then also we're working on being able to capture external referrals. We want to be mindful of the state's requirement that we have to take patients not just from the MGB system, and so soon we'll be debuting a process by which we can take patients who've been tested outside of the MGB system through a referral process. Next slide. So this is our infusion capacity. We are in phase 1A right now, but you can see we've planned for a few phases. Our phase 1A infusion capacity is 35 infusions a week using both the Brigham and MGH capacity. Dana-Farber is listed on here as they are co-developing this with us, but receive their own supply of the drug, and they're not live yet, but in the future they plan to be, I believe, after the first of the year. We aren't using all of this capacity currently, and I'll talk about some of the bottlenecks. One is, again, a surprise is that all of the patients that we are offering it to are not taking us up on this offer, so we are making a significant amount of phone calls to offer this. And probably appropriately, some patients are not assenting to the treatment. But we do have capacity for more infusions per day, and we didn't know how this would turn out when we were developing this. We had wanted to make sure that we planned for all of the patients that we could possibly squeeze into our capacity, knowing what the demand might be. But it's been a learning experience going through this process with Emmy and all the rest of the team to understand what the uptake of this therapy will be. Next slide. This is, you can see some more details, and for your planning, I thought this might be useful for you as you are doing similar planning. You can see the hours of operation in the lower left-hand corner of our infusion areas running from 7 to 7:30 p.m. We don't use all of those hours now currently, but in our later stages of planning, we wanted to make sure that we were planning for this. And then we have notable weekend hours at the bottom, both Saturday and Sunday, that were added to the infusion schedule to accommodate these infusions if necessary. I will say, too, from a staffing standpoint, we've engaged the travelers through our oncology group to make sure that we have appropriate RN staffing for the infusions. The APPs, our cancer nurse practitioners, are supervising the infusion on site, and at the Brigham, there is an APP that's identified within their infusion center, which is a non-cancer infusion center, which is doing the supervision of the infusion on site. So the shared decision-making is done by a group of physicians that are calling patients prior to arrival, and then upon arrival for their infusion, the APP is supervising the infusion and making sure that it's safe. They apply the treatment plan that we've developed with these therapies, and then the RN in the infusion center is delivering the treatment. Next slide. This is a workflow for the patient allocation. You can see how if a patient is tested in MGB and they have a positive result, the ordering physician is notified. So one question that we receive commonly is, if you are ordering a COVID test, the process that we've developed, interestingly, could take all of the treatment using a monoclonal antibody outside of that relationship where the patient might have been ordered for a test by a primary care physician or an oncologist. We want to make sure that we're sending a notification back to that ordering provider to let them know that the patient is eligible for monoclonal antibody therapy and will be contacted by our shared decision-making clinicians to offer that treatment. We do have a box in the COVID order itself for COVID testing that allows a clinician to opt out. So if there is some characteristic of a patient that the physician or the APP who's ordering the COVID test knows ahead of time that the patient should not be offered this therapy, they have the ability to indicate that on the COVID testing order, which then would take them out of eligibility for this process. But due to the narrow window of appropriateness for this treatment, we felt like this couldn't go back to the ordering provider of the test as something to be managed as a result management tool and then get referred. This may change in the future as we get more familiar with these therapies and our ordering providers are more facile in making sure that they can offer them to the appropriate patients. But the way that we decided to start this process was to have this done automatically and by a different clinician group that was really focused on timeliness. Next slide. And here you see more details in how the patient is scheduled. So the RAC stands for that's the unit where these infusions are given. They monitor an Epic work queue for incoming referrals and are making sure that they are scheduled appropriately within that unit. Next slide. And then I should say also what is shown on that slide is how we allocate them across different infusion units. So the MGH and the Brigham work together to make sure that the patients are allocated in a fair way and that not one site is being overwhelmed with patient scheduling. Next slide. And this is the workflow for scheduling. We actually have a call center that works, contacts the patient to schedule them. Patients are reminded that the infusion should happen 72 hours, within 72 hours of testing. If the patient is non-English speaking, we use the interpreter services during all of these calls. And then the patient is scheduled for their infusion. At this point, too, like I said before, we are starting to use CVS for some home infusions, and we're trying to incorporate that into the workflow if a patient is unable to arrive at our infusion center. Next slide. This is what happens in the infusion. So these are workflows for the pre-treatment of, evaluation and shared decision making, and then the administration and treatment. And you can see here that is highlighted that the patient is monitored for an hour after the infusion. And then also we are calling the patient after the infusion to check in for additional any symptoms, and we do those checks weekly. Next slide. So some last thoughts operationally. We're very interested, like I said a few times, in home infusions. Home infusions are very appealing because of the low reported side effects to this administration. And the fact that we don't want to expose anyone to COVID, and also thirdly, because we don't want to displace other patients that need valuable resources in infusion. So we're going to continue to work on that channel for patients. I think another future direction, as Emmy talked about, is shared decision making. Shared decision making is done right now with a central team, but many patients are telling us when they talk to an unknown provider who calls them to speak about this therapy, that they would benefit from conferring with regular providers that know them, their primary care providers. And so finding a way to bring primary care providers into this decision-making process or to rehome the discussion for certain groups of patients with their primary providers that are very invested in this would be something that we're gonna look at for the future. I think that with just two infusion locations, if these infusions expand and our capacity and patients' appetite for this treatment expands, we will be looking into expanded infusion locations to make sure that not one infusion center is disproportionately affected by the capacity challenges for this. And then we will be working on external pathways to make sure that we serve the entire regional population if necessary. So I just want to thank everyone for the invitation to be here, and Emmy is my co-presenter as well. So thanks to everyone.
So thank you so very much to both of you. I think that those were really phenomenal presentations and hopefully helpful to everybody on the webinar. I can attest that I'm somewhat aware of the number of hours that both of you have put into this to get to the amazing work that you just presented. I do see one question in the chat about whether other respiratory diseases in terms of age plus respiratory diseases criteria would include asthma alone or other respiratory diseases, and if you could maybe just talk about those criteria.
Yeah, so I can take that. So under the EUA, chronic respiratory diseases like asthma would qualify somebody. Again, we are starting out both because of Massachusetts guidance and because of the clinical expertise within our own institutions. We are starting out with just age and BMI, and we're not aggregating. We made sort of a conscious decision to start that we're not doing sort of a point system where if you're 70 and have asthma or 70 and have cardiovascular disease, we're not kind of aggregating criteria. But under the EUA, asthma alone would qualify you if you have any chronic respiratory condition, whether it's interstitial lung disease, COPD, asthma, would qualify somebody. Because we knew that our ability to provide this, at least initially, would not meet even the demand within age and BMI, we're starting there. But yes, those patients and other states and other institutions are doing this differently and are treating everybody under the EUA the same. So there are different perspectives. Utah has a system where people refer themselves in and they get different points for different criteria. So there are many ways that different places are doing it. That's how we've chosen to do it here.
Excellent. So again, I really want to thank both of you so much. I think both in terms of the incredible thoughtful consideration of equity as well as just how much work went into operationalizing this is hopefully be helpful to everyone else on the webinar. We do want to let everybody know that there is an additional webinar that has been held by the National Emerging Special Pathogens Training and Education Center, NETEC, and it can be found on their website at netec.org. This, as you know, NETEC is hosted by Emory, Nebraska, and NYU, and is part of the same network of hospitals, the 10 centers for emerging special pathogens that we belong to as well, and we really think they do phenomenal work. So, as I mentioned before, these slides and this audio recording will be available shortly later today on our website at rdhrs.org. As always, if you have other questions or topics, please do reach out to us via our website. Please, of course, always reach out to the ASPR regional staff if additionally they can be helpful. We communicate quite regularly. I want to thank our presenters one more time, Dr. Rube and Dr. Lennis. I want to thank Gary. I'll turn it over to you, Gary, for closing remarks, and I wish everyone a very happy holiday season, which here in Massachusetts, we're ramping up vaccinations, which is yet more reason for joy.
Thanks, Paul, and Drs. Lennis and Rubin, thank you so much. The presentations, they were terrific, and happy holidays to all of you as well. Thanks.